You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Sherman Alexie, the award-winning novelist, poet, and screenplay writer, has just published his first novel in 10 years. It's narrated by Zitz, a 15-year-old half-Indian, half-Irish throwaway kid who, after being shuttled from one foster home to another, decides to commit a horrifying crime, only to be shot in the head himself. And that's just the beginning of the story. Flight is published by Grove Press Black Cat, and I'm very pleased it has brought Sherman Alexie back to my show today. Hello.
It's good to see you again. It's been too long.
Zitz describes himself as a time-traveling mass murderer, and he finds himself in the bodies of people on both sides of American and Indian tensions throughout the past two centuries, even in situations that have nothing to do with Native Americans. How did you choose the types of people that he would inhabit?
Well, the book started off, the first impulse was when I was watching a 9/11 documentary, and they interviewed one of the flight instructors who taught those terrorists how to fly. And he was talking about how those guys would come to his apartment and they would get drunk and sing songs and tell stories, and they were friends. And so that combination of that personal betrayal against that backdrop of an epic crime just stunned me and hurt me. And so I wrote a fictional version, a fictional flight instructor teaching a fictional terrorist how to fly. And so it was that combination of personal betrayal, epic crime, that got me thinking about other moments in American history.
So out of that, we get the title Flight. We get betrayal and revenge.
Yes, which, you know.
The Zitz come later.
Zitz came later. The thing is, I was working on a young adult novel that's coming out in September, but that's a much more tender, funny book. But this other angrier, dislocated, disassociated voice kept popping up, and I would go on tangents with him for 5 or 6 pages and then put that aside and write the other book, and then 5 or 6 pages of disassociation would come. And then finally I realized that I needed to address that other voice, and I did, and it was Zitz.
And Zitz does have a distinctive voice here. It was just something that grew out of the material?
Yeah, I guess.
Because he's charming, you know, he's angry and he's charming all at the same time.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's a borderline personality. He's definitely psychotic at moments and certainly has some sociopathic tendencies. So I guess it was my inner sociopathic teenager that was dying to get out. But, you know, in this era of we've been in a war, the longest sustained war, in my adult life. And so I think, you know, and as my children, my two sons ask me more and more questions about it and what does it mean, I think Zitz was trying to answer those questions for me and for them.
One of the people Zitz inhabits is a present-day Indian who's poverty-stricken and lives on the streets. He also has a huge amount of hostility toward white people and blames them for his problems. Is it still constructive for Native Americans today to blame white people for their problems?
I think it's actually very debilitating. One of the things I was taught growing up certainly was to be suspicious of white people and, moreover, whiteness. But
then you went to white public schools.
But then
did
I went
that
to white,
change everything?
It's immediately started changing. I realized at that moment that I belonged to all sorts of tribes and that my primary identification, and to this day, my primary identification is the obsessive compulsive bookworm tribe. That's where I fit in best. So I think identifying yourself culturally or racially to extremes is always dangerous, and I think that really hurts Native Americans.
But you also must have been aware of the way people identified Native Americans and how their ideas of what you were like, which differed from what you really were like.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of just sort of objective hatred when I was growing up. I got spit on standing on Spokane Street corners. When I first went to the white high school, I transferred from the reservation school to the white high school. They were scared of me. And here I was, this geeky bookworm, but they had these ideas of me as being this, alcoholic, rageful warrior guy who was going to scalp a bunch of other 13-year-olds.
And did you go to the white school simply because you felt you could get a better education?
Oh, that was the only reason, the primary reason.
One of the people that Zitz inhabits is an FBI agent in the 70s who helps to assassinate radical Indian activists.
With the help of other radical Indian activists. One of the major themes in the book, as Zitz says, is how do you tell the difference between the good and the bad guys when they say the same things? And I would add to that, how do you tell the difference between the good and the bad guys when they use the same violent methods to advance their political causes? And when I look back at the American Indian movement and other political activities during the 70s, the people whose politics I generally agree with, you know, lefties, I certainly don't agree with the use of some of their violence. And so in the American Indian movement, there were a lot of guns. And I always found it ironic and hypocritical that the left, which is so often anti-gun and anti-violence and anti-war, embraces political organizations that use war as a valid political tool.
There's a problem in writing about this sort of thing in that it's you got to deal with the stereotypes. And sometimes reality merges with stereotypes.
The thing is, I don't believe in stereotypes when it comes to Native Americans. Alcoholism, poverty, social dysfunction, it's all very real. And anybody who calls it a stereotype is in a heavy set of denial. Just speaking autobiographically, I'm a recovering alcoholic. I've been sober for 15 years, but I'm an alcoholic. My father died 3 years ago of alcoholism, and his name was Sherman Alexie. I'm Sherman Alexie Jr., so if you want an anti-stereotype.
So you grew up in an environment in which it was just the norm.
I grew up in a cold, damp, booze-soaked house and reservation.
My guest is Sherman Alexie Jr., we discover. His latest novel is called Flight, and it has been published by Black Cat, which is an original imprint of Grove Atlantic. And why is it being issued as a paperback first?
It was a chance to publish alongside my politics. One of the problems...
reaching a public that might not be able to...
Might not be able to afford the book, generally. When you talk about a hardcover, you're talking about $25. So what I found on my book tour is that more people are apt to buy the book, younger people, college students, or they're more apt to buy more copies, or they're more apt to buy this book, the new one, and then back catalog of mine. But I also did it because the hardcover publication world, not for me, I have a very successful career, but it's very difficult for all sorts of other writers, and the hardcover model is sort of broken. And so I think that if somebody with my career publishes an original paperback, it might get rid of the stigma that it's somehow a lesser form of publication and that other first-timers and international writers who don't have a reputation here, experimental writers, will see it as a more valid means of publication. And it's far more economically feasible.
Now, Zitz finds himself at the beginning in his 20th foster home. Is 20 an exaggeration?
Oh, no, not at all. It's not common, but certainly it's not uncommon to meet a foster kid who's been in that number of homes.
Because they act out and they just get sent off to the next one?
Especially somebody as violent and disturbed as Zitz, a character like Zitz. Growing up, my family took in a lot of foster kids. Grading on a curve, we were one of the more stable homes, so we took in a lot of foster kids and ended up raising a couple cousins as siblings. And now in my adult life, I do a lot of work with poor and disadvantaged youth. So I meet a lot of kids who've been through these sort of that number of foster homes.
The ghost dance is also a theme in this book. Does the ghost dance remain a popular notion throughout the Native American population?
No, not really. I mean, the ghost dance, which, was Wovoka's, very Christian influence. People think it's a Native American theology, but it's not. Wovoka was a Lutheran, a Methodist minister, so it's very Christian. The apocalypse. Ghost dance is very apocalyptic and very Christian. The notion that if enough Indians dance this dance long enough, white people would disappear and all the dead Indians would return. So it took a white kid in jail named Justice to convince an Indian Zitz that the ghost dance, a 21st century version, would bring back his parents. So once again, it was sort of the missionary work of white folks inside my novel that convinces an Indian to commit acts of violence.
Well, how does it lead Zitz to the bank where he begins his shooting spree?
He meets Justice in jail, and Justice ends up quoting all these leftists and some rightists, political theorists and academics and intellectuals to intellectually convince him that death is the way to go and violence is the way to go. And then he trains him with paint guns.
I see also the spirit of Kurt Vonnegut here in Slaughterhouse 5. Was that...
Oh, very much so. you know, Billy Pilgrim in Slaughterhouse-Five comes unstuck in time. And I've always wanted to write an unstuck in time novel. So as soon as I thought about an indie kid in different bodies, Billy Pilgrim came immediately to mind. And also Kurt Vonnegut's satirical sense, his humor. The book has an epigraph at the beginning from Slaughterhouse-Five, the bird, you know, Putuit. So definitely. And, you know, the awful coincidence of Kurt Vonnegut dying the same week the book was published.
You've said in an interview Native American literature has not caught up to the rest of literature in terms of quality, in terms of quantity, in terms of worldview. We're still very provincial. Are you talking about Louise Erdrich and Leslie Marmon-Silko and Scott Momaday? And I can probably name four or five more.
I'm not necessarily talking about them in their careers because, you know, they have well-established international careers. I'm talking about the influence. There's been no younger writers who've come up to have a larger worldview. There has really been no second generation.
Why do you think that is?
I'm not sure. I'm really, Susan Power and I are the last Native American writers to really launch big careers, and she sort of disappeared for various reasons after she published her Grass Dancer in 1996. There's been no gigantic new Indian created novel, new writer since 1996. So obviously something is going on.
And it's weird because it isn't like that first generation was totally ignored, but we've seen with the especially the Latina tradition that developed here, attention was paid and more writers came along. There was a lot of attention paid to this new generation of Native American writers. Films have been made based on some of the books, and yet it hasn't continued. You think it's something that has to do with what's going on in the reservations?
Well, no. I mean, 70% of Native Americans don't live on the reservation. We're an urban population now, by and large. And when you're talking about Native American writers, even the young ones that I know, by and large, they're college students. They're academics. So that's not really it. I think part of it is, you know, Harold Bloom has that book about the anxiety of influence. I think in the Native American world, it might be the narrowing effect of influence. I think the next generation of Native American writers sounds too much like the previous generation. I don't think they've taken wildly experimental turns. I don't think, you know, for lack of a better term, you know, you haven't seen the Indian academic novel. You haven't seen the academic farce. You haven't seen the David Lodge novel. You haven't seen the epic, you know, Jonathan Franzen novel. You haven't seen the Jonathan Latham pop culture novel. You haven't even seen, you know, the Jhumpa Lahiri international novel. So I think we're still very domestic. I think our political sovereignty has become a form of artistic sovereignty.
And you take real chances here because, for example, some of these characters are almost caricatures on purpose, obviously. This is the sort of thing that somebody who is afraid of being in a shaky tradition might not take. But you really push things.
That's my job. I am not a social worker. I'm not as a writer. I'm not a political activist. Not as a writer. I'm an artist. I'm a writer. I'm a trickster and a comedian and a satirist.
So what took you so long to write another novel? 10 years.
Well, it took me 10 years to publish another novel. I've written three others in the meantime, but they were awful. So they will remain hidden.
You mean even experienced writers like you write awful novels? You know they're awful.
Oh yeah. I mean, one in particular, which I set in the days immediately following the release of Saturday Night Fever, where a bunch of guys on the Spokane Indian Res decide to open a disco, and their mission in life is to get John Travolta to be there for the opening. It's terrible. So
Somebody out there right now saying, hey, wait, that isn't such a bad idea. I'm going to write that book.
It's called Disco Inferno.
You can take it.
Yes, you can have it. You can have the idea. Was that Brad? You can have the idea, Brad.
Well, I'm glad that you wrote this one. Is there another book that you're proud of that you're working on?
I have a young adult novel coming in September called The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian from Little Brown. I have a family memoir I'm working on about my grandfather and father. My grandfather died in Okinawa in World War II, and he was a war hero, and we didn't know it.
Well, after all of these years of Native Americans being told that they should be ashamed of their tradition to some degree, or they were the enemy, are things working out?
You know, I gradually and slowly we're becoming more and more mainstream, and I have two stories about that. I was in the Soaring Eagle Casino in Northern Michigan recently for a gig, and I was checking into the hotel there, and I heard a commotion behind me, and I turned around, and Jay Leno was walking through the casino. He was performing there that night, too. So Jay Leno and I were performing at the casino on the same night. How could you not be more mainstream? And the other one is, when I went to the white high school, I was the only Indian. I was accepted in some ways, completely estranged in others, and dealt with a lot of active and passive racism. We recently had my 20th year high school reunion, and we had it at the Northern Quest Indian Casino. And when I walked in, I saw a lot of former people who had issues with me from the white community hanging out with my cousins. So I'd always thought of, you know, casinos as dens of capitalistic iniquity and vice, but they're also
part of the assimilation process.
Community centers.
Well, that's an idea for a book. The casino as a community center.
There you go, Brad. Another idea.
Sherman Alexie's Flight is available in paperback, original imprint from Grove Atlantic Incorporated, in their Black Cat series. I want to thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you.